The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, an interview about one of my favorite fiction writers, Flannery O'Connor, and the editor with whom she had a fruitful working relationship, Robert Giroux. O'Connor is also a favorite of Jesuit Father Patrick Samway, and he was friends with Giroux. Both O'Connor and Giroux were Catholic. Father Patrick's incredibly well-researched new book is Flannery O'Connor and Robert Giroux, a publishing partnership. Back in a moment with Father Patrick. First, though, a reminder that WESU has launched its fall pledge drive. Anything you can give to help support the station that brings you this program is greatly appreciated. So appreciated, in fact, that for a donation of any amount, yes, any amount, I will send you your choice of books on a list posted at reasonablycatholic.com. You can donate at WESUFM.org/pledge or by mailing a check to the station at 45 Broad Street, Middletown, Connecticut, 06457. Then contact me through the reasonablycatholic.com blog and I'll send you the book of your choice. Thanks in advance.
Hello, this is Arthur Myers, and I'm very happy to participate in this effort to bring greater awareness of WESU to the area. During the week, if I can listen, I am especially interested in Reasonably Catholic because of its breadth of participation of various people. I was on it myself. On the weekend, I'm especially listening to some of the alternative music or music that I wouldn't ordinarily listen to, whether it's from different countries or certainly younger recording artists. Otherwise, during the week, if you're able to listen to it, you have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and those kinds of programs that are just plain broadening for anybody. And I urge you to both continue to listen and support WESU. Thank you.
Welcome, Patrick Samway, S.J. Shall I call you Father Patrick? What do you prefer?
Father Samway or just Patrick?
Okay, great. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on your book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
It's so thoroughly researched and covers so much unplowed ground, at least in my experience of Flannery O'Connor. But I think first, for the benefit of the listeners who may not be familiar with Flannery O'Connor, she is long dead now and not exactly a household name. And along with that, neither is the other subject of your book, her editor, Robert Giroux. So just we'll start maybe with a little biography. She wrote in the 50s and died young of lupus.
Right.
Why are you interested in her now?
Well, I did my advanced studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in Literature of the American South. And when I was at Chapel Hill, she was one of the authors I read very carefully.
Yes.
And subsequently, once I started teaching in college, university, you know, I would spend some time with her fiction. So I came to appreciate what she had done.
Yeah.
My real entree, though, was through Bob Giroux. I first met him when I was working on my Walker Percy biography.
Yes.
I had just begun to do some research. And he asked me once, he said, "What are you working on?" I said, "Walker Percy." And he said, "Well, Walker's editor." And I said, I knew that because I had started some research. And he said, we'd like to publish the biography. And I said, that's great. So 2 weeks later, he sent me a contract. And I hadn't written a word at that point.
Huh.
And he gave me a tremendous gift. That is, there was no due date for the book.
Luxury.
So I didn't have to rush to complete it by a certain date.
Yeah.
And that liberated me enormously to go into as much biographical depth as I could.
May I just interrupt again, because I probably gave too little information to the listener.
Right.
We should mention that both Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy were Catholic writers. It wasn't a kind of obvious thing to find in their writing. It was kind of just woven in very subtly. I think you'd agree?
Right. Walker was a convert, whereas Flannery was,
a cradle Catholic.
A cradle Catholic. And so there's a difference between the two of them in their approach to religion, I think. But both were very devout Catholics.
Is that part of your interest in first Percy and then O'Connor?
Actually, most of the work I've done has been on William Faulkner.
Oh.
And
not a Catholic.
Not a Catholic. But I came to know certain writers like Walker Percy and André Debus who were Catholic.
Ah.
And because I knew them, I began to write about them.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't search out Roman Catholic writers. In fact, I think I shied away from that initially because I didn't want to beat a drum for Roman Catholicism.
Were you a priest at the time you were pursuing your literary pursuits?
Yes, I was. I went to Chapel Hill right after my ordination.
Okay. Well, okay. Just a little more lay of the land. Flannery O'Connor, although she wrote a couple of novels, she was largely, I think it's safe to say, a short story writer. And one kind of striking thing, maybe people will remember her when they hear this, her characters often came to a violent death. Isn't that safe to say?
A violent death?
Yes. Don't her main characters kind of meet a violent end, typically?
Not necessarily in the short stories.
No?
I think in the short stories, if you look at the pictures of Diane Arbus, the photos, you can see that she chooses people, we might call them freaks today, or people who are a bit unusual.
Yes.
It's like if you walk in the South into a supermarket, a Piggly Wiggly supermarket, you see typical Southerners there. And Flannery said that, I think it's safe to say that while the South is hardly Christ-centered, it is certainly most Christ-haunted.
Hmm. That's right. She was a Southern writer, we should point out.
Yes. So that she really wanted to look at people who were kind of going through ordinary experiences at certain moments in their lives. And those moments turned out to be decisive for them in terms of their change of view.
Mm.
Did they want to become open to maybe what the scriptures say, or what, say, Catholic spirituality? Did they want to become open to that, or were they not so interested in it?
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So she always brought her characters, at least in my mind, to that brink of beginning to see something, and then she would back away. And many of the stories end asymptotically. They kind of go off the curve, and the curve goes out to infinity.
Oh.
And we have to think. They become traps for meditation. We have to think, what is she doing in this story? Because she doesn't bring it to a complete resolution as such.
Huh.
But
say that word again. It's a cool word.
Asymptotical. It's a mathematical term. When you have a graph and you have a curve that comes down and it goes off into infinity without stopping.
Yeah.
And I like the way your stories don't come to a closure.
Yeah.
But they end there, and you have to think about what has happened.
Yeah.
In the story. And that forces you back to a second reading of the text, and perhaps a closer reading at that point.
Hmm. Well, you and I, in our emailing, we hatched a few questions that you might answer. Sure. Why don't we turn our attention to the question of your mission here with this book? What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, what I was trying to do was to link. We normally think of a writer writing in an isolated way, say in a room, and thunder thinking away about this book or that book, and then sending the manuscript to the editor, who sits and goes through with a red pencil.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always the case. If you think of Flannery, she learned that she had lupus, and that is a kind of an illness that affects the marrow of the bone.
Yeah.
And it caused her to become weaker and weaker. She's writing.
Her father died of it.
Yes, in 1941.
So she lived with that awareness that she had a fatal disease.
She did. Though her mother kept it from her for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
1951 to 52. The mother...
Others also knew and didn't tell her, right? Friends of hers.
Yes, Sally Fitzgerald was for one of them. But then Sally prompted this disclosure to Flannery. So after 1952, she was aware that she had lupus. And at first, they were able to control it, you know, through a drug.
Mm-hmm.
ACHT, and then gradually it became worse.
I'm curious, do you happen to know if that was a steroid?
I'd have to look it up again.
Yeah.
I didn't know it once.
You know why I ask? Because she was remarkably prolific, especially toward the end. She kept writing and writing, and I'm thinking, could this be the effect of steroids, you know?
I'm not quite sure the exact nature of the drug.
Yeah.
I prefer not to get into it.
Sure.
But it kind of went into a slight remission, and then it came back again. And forced her to go to the hospital several times. And when she did go to the hospital, she'd go into Atlanta from Milledgeville,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes in an ambulance.
That's in Georgia.
And, yes. And then she'd stay in the hospital for 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
So it was very draining on her, I think.
Yeah.
But she never really stopped writing. In fact, when she was in the hospital towards the end of her life, she was still writing while in bed.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, unbelievable. Just unbelievable, the strength that she had.
On the other hand, though, you think maybe it's kind of a therapy for her.
Could be, though I think she had that kind of missionary zeal of going to the very end and using all the strength that she had and not stopping.
When you say missionary zeal, though, she wasn't proselytizing. Or what do you think? What was her goal here with her writing and as it is informed by her Catholicism or not?
We have to remember that she died in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was not aware of Vatican II.
Yeah.
Because the decrees of Vatican II came out around 1965 or so. So she was in the wake of Vatican I, which was in the 1860s.
Yeah.
And that was a church where the liturgy was in Latin, and where devotions were very, very important, and where families went to church together, and so on. And she never wavered in that. And when she wrote letters to some of her friends, particularly one friend, Betty Hester, she tried to share very much the depth of her Catholicism. And she was continually reading books on spirituality and writing reviews of these books, too. So she was constantly growing. And I think, too, she's a person who could sit down and meditate and absorb the significance of what was going on in the liturgy, particularly the Mass. It's a time to just reflect on, you know, the graces she had received and to say yes to them and to continue to be open more and more to those graces.
Yeah, and in fact, Betty Hester, her very good friend and correspondent, did convert, however briefly.
That's right. And I think the best letter she wrote to Betty Hester. Unfortunately, Betty Hester ultimately committed suicide.
Yeah, and she counted her Catholic years as the worst of her life.
Yeah. It was,
it didn't take.
No, but I don't think that takes away anything with what Flannery said to her.
Absolutely.
Because when you read the letters in The Habit of Being, they're absolutely marvelous letters.
Yeah.
To all her friends, she took time to write those letters and to be very careful and to reply to the questions people were asking her or sharing with her. And that in itself is a form of sharing the good news, I think.
Sure. If you are just joining us, this is an interview with Father Patrick Samway, whose latest book is titled Flannery O'Connor and Robert Giroux, A Publishing Partnership. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more from Father Patrick Samway.
My name is Father John Baptist Pesch from Holy Family Monastery in West Hartford. I think this is a great contribution to what the Church is supposed to be at all times, but especially in our day when we're emphasizing more and more the Church as the people of God. It's a wonderful program, and I'm glad that Maria Johnson, she took the challenge up when she recognized that there were certain voices that were not giving the proper impression of the way Catholics should respond to the realities of life in the political and social order. I'm in favor this, even though maybe sometimes I hear things that I don't really approve of. So what? I mean, nobody has a monopoly on what the Church is. I encourage you to really to support this by your prayers. We always say that and we mean it. But I also mean this. Any kind of a sacrifice you can make to give to the program is well worth it. And I really hope that if I disturbed your conscience a little bit, I hope you'll make the most of it. Thanks a lot.
You know, it may be a bit of a tangent, but it's also kind of related since we're talking about Betty Hester. I learned from your book who the person who's only identified as the letter A in The Habit of Being, which is the collected letters of Flannery O'Connor. I only learned from your book that we now know who A is. So I have a couple of questions about that. Do you know if it was Flannery who assigned her the letter A?
No, that was Sally Fitzgerald.
Do you know what?
Because Sally wanted to, you know, preserve her anonymity, I think.
Okay. Because the only other Hester I'm familiar with from reading is Hester Prynne of the Scarlet Letter.
Right.
And that letter is A.
Oh.
And I thought,
maybe that's
why she's called A.
No, I think it was just the first letter in the alphabet.
Oh, okay.
It could have been a B.
Okay, Betty, right?
Yeah. I never made that connection.
That's funny. So you were talking about your mission in writing the book, and it seems to be connected to the fact that Flannery O'Connor was kind of a hero producing beautiful, I would say brilliant works of genius,
right,
even throughout her debilitating illness. But then where her editor comes in is also part of your mission.
Right, because I said before, I knew Bob Giroux fairly well, about 20 years. And we would have dinner maybe once a month together during that time period. And I presided at his funeral.
Hmm.
And you have to recall that he was editing some very famous people at the same time. T.S. Eliot, Elizabeth Bishop, Robert Lowell, Isaac Bashevis Singer, Theodore Welty, John Berryman, Thomas Merton, Carl Sandburg, and others.
Yeah.
And also Flannery. And so Flannery is asking in her own way, you know, I'm going to submit to you this material. Would you look it over and give me feedback? And Bob had to say, yes, I would do that. And I'll do it in a very professional way. At the same time, he's dealing with four catalogs a year from Harcourt Brace or Farrar-Straus and Giroux, and trying to deal with all these other authors. So it's kind of how they come together, the two of them. It's kind of the interaction between these two individuals. And I found that very fascinating.
How would you characterize their relationship?
Oh, I think it was very, very warm, very, very, very mutually reverential.
Yes.
Bob, unfortunately, decided to leave Harcourt Brace.
He was kind of forced out, it sounds like.
Well, it was around 1955. Bill Jovanovich, William Jovanovich, became the president of Harcourt Brace, ultimately Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, and he wanted to have the company produce more textbooks, because textbooks were becoming very, very popular at that point, and put less emphasis on poetry and on fiction, which upset Bob very much, because Bob was editor-in-chief at this point.
Yeah.
And then Bob asked to be a director of the firm, which is only natural when you're editor-in-chief to be one of the directors.
Yes.
And he was told point-blank, no, because you're a Roman Catholic.
Gosh.
You can't be a director.
I didn't know. It must have gone by me that it was that overt.
Yes.
Wow.
And Bob wrote letters to a number of friends. He wrote letters to John Berryman, Thomas Merton, Paul Horgan.
Hmm.
And the best letter he wrote about this was to a writer on the West Coast called Jessamine West. And he explains exactly his reaction to being told, no, he could not be a director, and that the reason was because he was a Roman Catholic. So he waited a few months before leaving because he wanted to get a pension.
Yeah.
And then he left, and Flannery stayed with Harcourt Brace.
Right.
And she had two editors after that.
Was that a kind of act of disloyalty that she stayed with the firm?
No, I'd say just the opposite. Harcourt Brace was her company.
Okay.
And she felt a loyalty to them. And so Catherine Carver, who was Bob's assistant, became her editor. And she was apparently a very wonderful woman, a very quiet woman.
Mm-hmm.
She had never met Flannery at that point. So she had worked for, Catherine Carver had worked for the Partisan Review and had read some of Flannery's stories. So she was familiar with Flannery's works. And then Catherine Carver quit after a year.
Right, right.
And so Flannery was passed on to Denver Lindley, who I take it was a very mild-mannered man. He had gone through Princeton, but he was more interested in translating German novels into English and publishing those. And I don't think he really understood what Flannery was doing in her fiction.
Yeah.
And then Denver quit, too. So Flannery accepted Bob's invitation to go to Farrar Straus at this point. And Harker Brace really wanted her to stay with them. In fact, two of the directors went down to meet her in Milledgeville to persuade her to stay. But she ultimately said, no, I've had three editors there. And
that's too many in a short, short time.
With Bob Giroux.
So, you know, I'm aware of the incredible research it must have taken for you to get so deeply into the weeds of the publishing world and comings and goings and contracts and changes to manuscripts and all of that. I mean, did you live in archives? I'm curious about your process.
I think so, yes. I was fortunate enough to have found, because no one had seen them before, they were kind of hidden, the Flannery O'Connor archives at Harcourt Brace.
Ah!
So I found those.
Usually they're at universities.
These weren't.
But they held on to them.
They did.
Hmm. Excellent.
And then,
my husband's an archivist, so
he is.
I appreciate that.
Oh, well. And then Bob Giroux had about 40 letters in his files in his apartment.
Okay.
So we had original letters from Flannery O'Connor, plus his carbon copies.
All right.
And I found some of the carbon copies in the Harcourt Brace files, too.
But also so much more. I mean, your book is just bursting with detail.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, but I don't want readers to think it's kind of a slog. it's an excellent read.
You know,
how did you do this? What is your life like as a priest? You're a priest slash scholar. What's
well, teaching at a university. I teach at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. I retired about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So when I was writing this book, I was teaching at the same time. And I would write every single day or do some research every single day, too. And then during the summers, I would focus on this and have a chance to travel. But you don't do something unless you really enjoy it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I find that if I can share what is important to me and the way I do it, my methodology, with others, then they can appreciate the world I live in, too.
Uh-huh. Very good.
So I see it very much, I think as a Jesuit, we tend to do research and publish.
Yeah.
And this is part of the Ignatian charism, if you will,
mm-hmm.
for those who teach at various universities.
Okay. Now, yeah, that makes sense. I didn't put all the parts together as well as you just did. Very good. Yeah, now it feels more like part of your vocation. It's just organic to your whole being.
I think so.
Yeah. It's great. It's great. I'm very appreciative of you Jesuits. So, let's go back to Flannery. You know, she was a strange duck. I think it's safe to say. And it's funny, I should land on that because she did kind of keep birds.
She did.
Yes. You know, peafowl and ducks and, yeah.
I don't know whether she was strange or private.
Okay. All right, that's fair. That's fair.
I think, you know, her father died when she was about 14. And they were very close to one another, but he wasn't there during her later teenage years.
Yes.
And so Flannery lived most of her life with her mother.
Right.
And then when her lupus became pronounced, they left the Klein house, I call it a mansion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Greek Revival mansion in Milledgeville. And Flannery's cousin, Louise Floncourt, still lives in the house. And they moved out to a farm that belonged to the family called Andalusia.
Mm-hmm.
And they moved out there so Flannery could have some privacy to write.
Mm-hmm.
She lived on the first floor, whereas if she lived in the mansion, she'd have to climb up to a bedroom on the third floor.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much easier for her to do what she wanted to do out at the farm. And while she's out there, she could receive visitors. And I don't think we should think of her as a Southern Belle of Amherst,
Right, right, like Dickinson.
Yeah, she gave 60 talks and lectures when she was out at Andalusia.
Yes,
so she was on the road a good bit.
And she had fellowships at writers' colonies, and she was in New York to see publishers. And since we're coming to our listeners by way of Wesleyan University in Connecticut,
right,
we should add that she had a Connecticut connection, Reading, Connecticut, where friends owned a home.
Right.
Yeah.
The Fitzgeralds, Robert and Sally Fitzgerald, they were very, very good to her. And Robert, as you know, was teaching various places, ultimately at Harvard. And Sally raised the children. They lived for some time in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sally began to write Flannery's biography.
This is after Flannery died?
No, this was... I think you're right. I think most of it was after Flannery died in 64. Yeah. It was going to be published in the 90s, but it was never published.
Oh.
And but she did bring out the letters.
Yes, right.
And she wrote on Flannery, too, in various literary journals. So I think she had a very fine understanding of what Flannery was trying to do in the various essays that I've read. I only heard Sally speak once,
mm-hmm,
and that was at Emory years and years ago. And I found her very, very learned in the way she approached O'Connor's writings.
Can we talk a little bit about Flannery O'Connor's spiritual side, her Catholicism particularly? My sense of her is that she's kind of a right-leaning, if you will. she's a down the line. I think she had a comment. It's not quoted in your book, but I read that she said something about, she'd rather see the world just bursting with overpopulation than condone birth control. I thought she was a bit doctrinaire. Have I got her right?
Well, I approach it a bit differently.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
Well, recall that she was a devout Catholic.
Right.
I think the word devout sounds... Some people interpret that as being a robot Catholic.
Okay.
You do this, and then do that, and do this.
Yeah.
Well, she was very much an informed Catholic.
Yes.
And I would start by saying that she believed in the creed. She really did. That there's one God in three persons. Three persons. And a person can understand and speak.
Hmm.
And that the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, the Holy Ghost, are consubstantial. They share the same substance. Jesus is not an adopted son, but he is God. And Flannery took the creed and the sacraments of the church very deeply. That was, an innate part of her spirituality.
One of my favorite lines of hers has to do with the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And I think what she said was, if, as the Protestants say, that it's a symbol, then, quote, the hell with it.
Right, right. So she believed, as you say, in the real existence of God. And then the problem is, if God is a person, or three persons in the Trinity, then how can God be present in bread and wine? That's a real mystery, isn't it? And this is where she kind of drew on Thomas Aquinas, because the church that she knew was heavily influenced by Thomas Aquinas and his theology. And Thomas was dealing precisely with this problem of can you prove the existence of God? And how do you do that from a rational point of view? Not from revelation, not from scripture, but from reason. And he went through some investigation into words like matter and form, act and potency. But how is this possible? And when Flannery portrays, say, a spiritual image in one of her stories, she doesn't do it directly but obliquely. Mm-hmm. And she does it through a notion of analogy. For example, analogy is when something is like something but different from it too, but there's a close relationship. And yet Catholics believe that Jesus is present to us, with us, and in us. And so if you take a look, for example, at a story like The Displaced Person, mm-hmm. you know, who is the displaced person? Well, it's a Polish man who, in the story, dies. He's on a farm. He's come to work on the farm. And after he dies, then the workers, the farm workers, all tend to disappear, including the African-Americans. And the only one left is the elderly woman who owns the farm, Mrs. McIntyre. And the priest who's in the story, he says, Flannery only has two priests in all her stories. And one is a Jesuit who doesn't know who James Joyce is. She put us in our place, I think. But this other priest comes out, and he brings bread to feed the peacocks. And earlier, he had seen a peacock with its tail displayed, and he says, Christ will come like that, meaning the transfiguration. Christ will come in all his glory like that. And in a sense, he wants to give the bread to Mrs. McIntyre, the elderly lady who is very, very ill in bed. Maybe it's a symbol of the Eucharist, too, viaticum that he's bringing her. But we never really know. And the question is, will Mrs. McIntyre understand what the priest is saying towards the end of her life or not? Has that moment passed? So we're right there to observe that. And when we think of the Transfiguration, Jesus with his three disciples there, splendid. They couldn't believe this man in glorious white. Jesus was really apparent there as a divine person. But the same three men were also in the garden at Gethsemane, and they fell asleep.
Right.
You know, they were very slow learners. So Flannery's playing around, I think, with some of these images. She's not trying to answer a question, but more raise a question.
Yeah.
And, you know, she said, to those who are blind or going blind, you have to draw large figures.
Yeah.
And those who are hard of hearing, you have to shout.
This is an interview with Father Patrick Samway, who knows more about the late Flannery O'Connor and her circle than maybe anyone. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. It's you that puts the community in community radio. Please give during our fall pledge drive by going to WESUFM.org/pledge or by mailing a check to the station's address, WESU, 45 Broad Street, Middletown, Connecticut, 06457. Now back with Father Patrick.
Oh, the good man nowadays sure is hard to find.
You know, I'm still kind of fixated on the way her characters often, I'm thinking of A Good Man is Hard to Find, and others too, where the main character achieves some kind of epiphany, if you will, a little enlightenment, but at the risk of his or her life, you know?
Well, you're right. That's a violent story. It's probably her most violent.
The
good man who's hard to find is Jesus, isn't he? He's very tough to find.
Oh, okay. Very good.
and if the misfit in that story had been with Jesus 2,000 years ago, he would have understood. But he wasn't there. So he doesn't know what really happened there. And what we forget in this life is that there is real evil.
Yeah. And in fact, we should clarify for our listeners who are not familiar with the story. It's about a family on a road trip with a grandmother, and on the radio comes news that there's this murderer, right, on the loose.
Right.
Is he a convict, escaped or something? I can't remember. Yeah. But he's known as the Misfit, and as bad luck would have it, the path of the Misfit and this family cross, and it ends badly for the grandmother. She gets killed by the Misfit, and O'Connor gives him the last word, you know? Like, she's not so bad if someone was there to kill her every day of her life, you know?
Because she was overly sentimental, romantic, you know? She had dressed properly in case there was an accident.
Yeah.
You know, the car was in an accident.
The grandmother now we're talking about.
Yeah. She sat in the back seat with the children.
Yep.
And there was an accident. The cat jumped at the father's shirt, and on the shirt was a parrot. It's only natural the cat leap towards a parrot, even though the parrot's in fabric. You know, there's a cause and effect there. It makes sense. But what doesn't make sense is the violence at the end.
Right.
I think...
because the grandmother says to him, oh, you're one of God's own children.
Yeah.
She's trying to kind of cultivate a connection with him that doesn't take.
Well, again, she says something like, you could be one of my children, too. I don't have exact words in front of me. But what she says... She doesn't enter into an honest discussion with him. She throws it at him.
A platitude.
Platitudes. And it just doesn't sink in with him. He doesn't accept them. And you know, when we hear the shots coming from the woods, as one by one, the members of the family are killed.
Yeah. It is that's right. Wow, the whole family. That's right.
Yeah.
I had blocked that out. Goodness. Wow. Well, it just goes to show you, nothing good ever came out of Florida.
I say nothing. I'm a New Yorker.
I knew there was a reason I liked you. Wow. What's your favorite story of O'Connor's?
Well, I think Good Country People.
But that one's so, oh my gosh, that's almost autobiographical, don't you think?
It is.
Talk about that. Tell the listeners what that's about.
Well, it's about this young woman who has a PhD in philosophy, and she has an artificial leg, so she's on crutches.
An invalid, then, like Flannery.
Yeah, it is. It is, you see. Living with her mother, and she's thumping around the house with her crutches, and her philosophy means nothing to her. She says she has seen through to nothing in philosophy. She knows nothing. That's what philosophy's taught her. And her mother goes, what? You have a PhD and you don't know anything? And a neighbor woman has two daughters who, you know, have a very active love life. And here, this girl, Joy, she changes her name to Holga, kind of an ugly-sounding name.
Yes.
And one day, they get a visitor, a surprise visitor. This Bible salesman comes along, and he's very polite, and he wants to sell the Bibles, and he stays for dinner, and Flannery's kind of taken with him.
Well, not Flannery, Helga. Freudian slip.
I mean, Helga. Yeah, Dr. Flannery. Yeah, I do identify them, though she rejected that type of identification. She's taking with him and accepts an invitation to go out on a little picnic with him. And they go out. It's like a 1940s movie with Rita Hayworth, you know, where they go out and they climb up. They go up into a barn and climb the ladder into the hayloft and everything. This guy is saying all the sweet words, and he asks her to take off her wooden leg up in the hayloft. Well, she'd never had that question asked before, especially with a fella. And he says, "Oh, you really don't love me then?" So she does it. Now, she's at her most vulnerable at that point.
Yeah.
He opens up the suitcase. You know, this dirty playing cards and condoms, whiskey, and he's a gigolo salesman.
Yeah.
And she's absolutely horrified. And he runs away.
With her leg.
With her leg.
He puts her leg in his suitcase.
Suitcase and takes it. Now the question is, for me anyway, will she ever open herself up to a love experience in the future? I mean, that is the key question.
Right.
You know, will she grow in love, or will she turn the spigot off and become a hermit and bitter and sad? That's a question many, many people face, I think.
Sure.
You have to recall that just before she wrote this story, she had fallen in love with a book salesman, one of Bob Giroux's assistants by the name of Eric Langier. And Eric would go in the South and other places and visit bookstores and meet writers and talk to them about their writing projects and try to place books in bookstores. And he met Flannery, and they would go out and take rides in the countryside. And at one point, he had to decide, you know, was he going to continue this relationship or not? And he was Danish, and he decided, no, he was not going to continue it, because if he did, then he would be marrying someone who was crippled. And so he went back to Denmark, and Flannery wrote him some letters. And one of my Jesuit friends, Mark Posco, who's at Georgetown, met Eric, who had moved back to the United States. And Eric allowed Mark to photograph, Xerox some of these letters.
Wow.
And Mark has published them. And so I learned about this from Mark Posco himself.
Yeah.
So Sally Fitzgerald had met Eric before that, but she never really reproduced the letters.
Yeah.
And Mark and I were on a panel once, and I was overwhelmed when he gave his paper about this relationship. So there might be some basis in fact, you know, that just as Olga was taken with Manly Pointer, so Flannery was taken with Eric. And
so what does this tell you?
In a sense.
Yes,
and,
I mean...
And it would have been something deeply disturbing to her.
Right. And so for her to put it in her fiction, as much as she says it's not autobiographical, does it say that she had some kind of self-awareness of that ultimate choice that she would have to make going forward, whether to become a bitter, closed-off person or...
Well, of course, that's interpretation, and that's my interpretation.
I mean,
anyone can interpret these from various angles, But I think that's one way of entering into the text.
Yeah.
In one of her letters to Eric after he left to go back to Denmark, she said, you know, when you read this story, you might think that I'm writing about you, but I'm not, dear boy. don't think you're that important in my life now, that type of thing.
Yes.
She had been terribly hurt by his leaving, I think. And
right.
So kind of ended that correspondence with him on that note.
We have barely a minute and a half left, and I can't believe the time has flown like this. We really didn't, maybe it came out, kind of seeped out in the interview accidentally, but we didn't point out what a really kind of funny writer she is, was. You know, she had a comedic touch.
She did. And I think, you know, that comes again from doing those cartoons in college, you know, mocking people, doing satires.
Yeah.
When she was in college, there were waves, you know, these women in uniform.
Oh, sure, right.
Who went to Georgia State College for Women, where she attended.
Yeah.
And they came, you know, in the hundreds there. And of course, they were all regimented and so on, and whereas the other co-eds were kind of just normal young women attending college.
Yeah.
And Flannery could imitate the and mock and satirize the habits of these waves. And I think that kind of rolled over into her fiction and showed that when she entered reality, she didn't flee from things. She entered it deeper and deeper. She often saw the funny side of things,
yes,
too.
Yes,
yes. Just not the tragic, but the funny
right.
side of things.
And, you know, I'm always struck. Every time I read about her or read her, I'm struck, especially when she's writing about her faith, about the depth of her theological understanding in her 30s, you know?
Right.
I mean, she was truly a genius.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you. And, you know, she still is read in college.
Yeah, that's
when you
good.
Go into a bookstore, Barnes & Noble's, for example, Barnes & Noble's has only so many feet of yeah. space for these novelists. And the new ones are demanding, you know, a couple of inches, a couple of feet
right.
for their books. But Flannery has her space there.
Yes.
And that's a good sign that she is perduring
yeah.
in the literary canon, if I can use that expression.
Yes. Oh, it's a blessing. Yeah.
Yeah, that she hasn't been taken off, whereas other writers, you know, have disappeared.
Yeah.
Back in the 1940s, Ellen Glasgow was very popular.
Yeah, right. Who's ever heard of
Ellen
her?
Ellen Glasgow today, except graduate students.
Right.
Who are doing PhDs.
Well,
so, you know, the writers come and go, but Flannery is still staying there, and I think she will stay for many years to come.
And I'm so grateful to you that you're doing your part to make sure that's the case.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Really. Patrick Samway, thank you for talking with us. This was really enlightening and enjoyable.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it, too.
That was an interview with Father Patrick Samway about his latest book, Flannery O'Connor and Robert Giroux, a publishing partnership. If you missed any of the episode or want to share it with friends, I'll post it later this evening at reasonablycatholic.com. Don't forget, for a donation of any amount to the station's fall pledge drive, I'll send you a book from a list I've posted at reasonablycatholic.com. Please give. The station relies on your support for 30% of its budget. Reasonably Catholic Keeping the Faith listeners have proven so generous in the past. Let's keep it up. Thanks. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.